Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Big thanks to Nifty Riffic for yesterday's reading. You asked a few questions. One of them was, do I listen to your readings? Clearly I do, because I heard the questions. You said, am I still watching The Sopranos? Yes, I am. I'm almost kind of finished it, actually, which happened so quickly. I only started it a few weeks ago. I was looking for something good to binge watch. I had tried The Sopranos before and not quite gotten into it, but I thought, you know what, I'll give it another chance. And I got into it, and now I'm almost finished. I can't believe it. I'm up to like halfway through season 5. It's a good show. It's making me feel like a gangster. I'll tell you something funny about Mafiosa, if you will indulge me here. So my dad's side of the family is Italian, and they're from the Aeolian Islands, a little island called Lipari, and another one called Stromboli. It's a volcano. And those islands are apparently where kind of like the mafia, the Italian mafia, came from, where it originally sort of started around there. Which is interesting. We went there when I was 15 to have a little poke around, see where my ancestors came from. We were trying to find out a bit about my great-grandpa. And what we learned was that he lived there and that he went to New York on business quite often. And that was about all we learned about him. But that was enough to kind of indicate that he was probably a mafia guy, because that was sort of where they first went to and where they had their first ties to, apparently. I don't really know how it all went, but we thought that was really funny. Me and my brother were like, how funny would that be if our ancestors were like got the Godfather? Anyway, so that was interesting. I was at a school recently and we were talking about like stories that echo through our ancestors and how it's cool to dig up like stories about ancestors. I was talking about, you know, my grandpa on my mum's side and my grandpa on my dad's side and all this kind of stuff, and then I told that story and I thought it was, you know, to me it's just an amusing story. I'm not a tough guy, you know, but I do look like I would fit in with like the Sopranos family, like that look. My dad is one of 8 brothers. And they basically all just look like Tony Soprano. So anyway, I told that story and thinking it would get a giggle out of these, you know, grade 5 and 6 kids. And I just see that the teacher's sort of nervously smiling, like, hi, what a good story, like at the back of the class. And the kids are just like kind of shrugging their shoulders, like, what's he talking about? Anyway, they all seemed vaguely scared of me after that. So that was not the desired effect of that story. So anyway, long story short, if you do find yourself talking to a classroom full of grade 5 and 6 kids, don't tell them that you are descended from the mafia. It doesn't go over very well. Second question that you asked was about getting banned from r/books. Yeah, no, I never got unbanned. I'm still banned. I only ever posted once there, and it was about the A Year of War and Peace project and the subreddit. And because I was the host of the podcast, I think they deemed it to be self-promotion. although they never told me. They never told me why they banned me. And it wasn't just a suspension or a ban from posting. It was like a flat ban from everything permanently. So I can't comment or upvote or anything. Seems like a bit of an overreaction for my first post. And then I wrote to the moderators asking, like, hey, like, I saw I got banned, just wondering what happened, and they never responded. So very unprofessional. I mean, but not that they are professionals, like, they're volunteers, they're not getting paid, so. But yeah, I don't know, like, if I had to ban someone from the Hemingway List subreddit permanently, I would be very reluctant to do that, and I would definitely let them know what happened. Like, I would discuss it with them if they asked, but that would be a real last resort. I would not want to do that at all. So anyway, yeah, still banned. But, you know, screw those guys. Who cares? The drink. Today's episode is brought to you by water, the beverage water, in a large stainless steel milkshake cup. Thanks for asking. Metal bands. Yep. So Jimmy, the guy in the metal band, the doom metal band, I was just a cameraman on that, so I've got to hand that footage over to him, and he'll cut up the film clip and edit it however he wants. But no, he hasn't done that yet. He hasn't actually collected the footage from me yet, so it's just sitting there. But it's a lot of fun. You know, it's kind of probably like similar to when they film a horror movie. Horror movies end up all grotesque and doomy and dark and gloomy, much like this metal film clip, but they are apparently, horror films are the most fun films to make, and it's just a big barrel of laughs mucking around and trying to make it look all spooky and stuff. And it's very much the same thing with a metal band, being in a metal band or being part of the film crew for a metal band film clip. It's just a big goof. It's a lot of fun. It's kind of strange because it's so gloomy and sullen and serious and dark, but actually the mood behind the music and behind the video is like, oh, how awesome is this? Let's see how metal we can make it, kind of thing. I've also been shooting a film clip for my band, Verona Lights. We started that on the weekend, and by about half an hour in, I broke one of the lighting rigs, my lighting rigs, blew the globe by bumping it a little bit. About 5 minutes after that, I blew the second one. Not to worry, I've still got a third one. We can just move it around a lot. And then I tipped that over and broke that. So I broke three lighting rigs in the space of an hour, within the first hour of shooting. And once the lighting rigs had all been broken, we then had to rely on like natural light and like the lights on the roof, like the house lights. And yeah, as the lighting got progressively worse, the film started to look more and more like a film student film, like a tacky arts graduate school film kind of thing. So I'm not really happy with it. I think we'll probably reshoot most, if not all of it. But hey, it was fun, even though it was a bit of a waste of time. So yep, filming's going good. What was the one last question you had? Oh, why do I record at 2 a.m? So it's about 11:45 now as I record this. The reason I record late, it's usually the last thing I do before I go to bed. And sometimes I go to bed later than other times. Occasionally I'll fall asleep or like doze off watching something. Thinking, oh, when this finishes, I'll get up and do the podcast. And then I wake up a couple hours later and go, oops, it's 3 a.m, better go do it. Which is why some of them probably sound really sleepy, because I'm literally like in the middle of having my sleep for the night. Get up, do a quick podcast, go back to sleep. That happens sometimes, not often. But mostly it's just like, I'll watch one more episode of The Sopranos and then I'll get up and do the podcast. And then I'm like, one more. I'll put one more on. And then before you know it, you know, it's 2 a.m. and I've still got to do it. I'm just a night owl and I'm bad at scheduling my time. All right. That was a long intro to a podcast. Hope that was somewhat entertaining. Anna Karenina, Part 2, Chapter 1. Kitty has gone and got herself some TB. Discuss. And why are the doctors always sexy in Tolstoy stories? Looking at you, Dr. Lorraine from War and Peace. I had a lot of fun when I did the Bogan translation of War and Peace, Part 1, in playing up the sexiness of Dr. Lorraine, because it seemed funny that Tolstoy did mention quite a few times that he's attractive, which is like, why do you keep saying that kind of thing? So I made him like super sexy. I should read you guys a little passage. Oh, I don't have a book handy. I'll find one for tomorrow's episode if anyone's interested. I'll read a little passage from Bogan, War and Peace, where Dr. Lorraine is like, his sexiness is dialed up a bit for my own amusement. Starfall 15 said, so far I quite like Kitty's father. He's the most sensible and thoughtful. He immediately realized that Vronsky is not a good prospect for his daughter, and Here he is the only one to perceive the true cause of her distress. Before her he decided to scatter his pearls, such contempt to the character of the celebrated doctor, in one simple sentence. Eula is a Pimp said, yeah, the father is my favourite of the minor characters in the book so far. Mango Mondo said, the quackery from Brothers Karamazov continues. Anyone know what sodden water is? Is sodden just a region? Corsio said, I guess it's mineral water from Bad Sodden in Germany. Bad Sodden is a place. Oh my god, it's beautiful. Oh my god, I don't go to Bad Sodden. They should have called it Good Sodden. I'm really sorry for that. Seriously. But it is quite beautiful. No, I don't know what sodden water is either. But yeah, the quackery. I think, you know, if you lived in the 1800s, medicine was mostly quackery everywhere. They just didn't know what they were doing. And I think if you go back even further, the further back you go in time, the more quackery the medicine is. God, it would have sucked. Wouldn't it have sucked to live back then? I am Norwegian said, poor kitty. That medical examination scene reminded me of some bottom of the barrel anime. Though the situation would be played for laughs. It's even worse that the doctor scorns her for not being progressive enough to realize that the situation is entirely natural. 19th century Russian authors really didn't like doctors, huh? At least this guy is better than Herzentube. It's like when you see an old guy in a business suit in a Hollywood movie. You just know he's at the very best going to be amoral. I laughed at the prescription of a trip to a German spa. It's become another thing I always expect when a 19th century doctor comes up. Well, I have no idea what to do. Why don't you take a nice trip to a sanatorium out in the Italian countryside? Yeah, I think it was just like, you need to go somewhere warm and dry and comfortable so that your immune system can bounce back. Pretty good advice, really. I mean, it's not a cover-all. It's not going to fix most things. But you are going to have a lot easier time recovering somewhere where you're not, like, freezing and damp and shivering. Right? Maybe. Is it TB? Said a Norwegian. I assumed it was Vronsky who had destroyed her vitality, guilt and sorrow and shame, etc., often presented itself in physical ailments in Dostoevsky's books. Half of the main cast ended up with brain fever. The same might be happening here. Hey, probably, maybe. He kept saying, what did he keep calling it? Like tuberculosis or something like that? Which maybe isn't tuberculosis. I might have just misunderstood that, potentially. I'm looking for the word here. Where was it? Tuberculosis. Oh, now I can't find it. Doesn't matter. Well, maybe she doesn't have TB. I could have got that wrong. False alarm, everybody. Don't panic. She doesn't have TB. For other people reading the book on Kindle, I Am Norwegian says, I recommend testing out the Chair Ink font. I switched to it yesterday and it feels like I'm reading an old book. It's a small change, but it really adds the experience. Okay, you can change the font to Chair Ink. What am I looking at here? I'm going to have a look what it looks like on on Google Images. Chair Ink font. Oh, it just looks like a font. Really? A serifed typeface font. Like you'd find in a novel. Okay, cool. Well, good little tip. Soma Stars said, 19th century Russian authors really don't like doctors, huh? Well, this was pretty true of all doctors everywhere during that time. Medicine was a fledgling field back then, and people didn't trust it. It's actually pretty interesting to dig back into the history and read about the wars between doctors and those they misplaced, like midwives and healers. Is it TB? It might just be Vronsky that destroyed her vitality. I agree with this. There was a brief sentence in one part of Kitty thinking exasperatedly, why can't they just see I'm broken-hearted and leave me alone? or something along those lines. The poor girl. Did you catch, says Swim, said the mama fishy, where the doctor washed his hands after the examination? I thought it interesting that Tolstoy included that, since washing of hands to prevent the spread of infections wasn't a normal thing back then, I believe. I think it probably was relatively normal by the later half of the 1800s. Yeah, I think it probably was by then. Maybe not. Jeez, I don't know. Probably wasn't like the norm, but I still think they would have known to wash your hands for germs and stuff like that. I laughed at the prescription of a trip to the German spa. Techrific said both Thomas Mann and Hermann Hesse wrote excellent books revolving around Kurorts, Man in the Magic Mountain, and Hesse's Kurgast. The latter is a very short book, and The Magic Mountain is, pardon the cliche, a mountain of a book. Both are excellent. I don't think the Hesse book is translated to English, but is available in Swedish. Brunngasten. I think you would enjoy it. Well, that's no good to me in Swedish. I'm a Norwegian, said, I've gotten some recommendations for Steppenwolf recently, so I'm working my way back to Hesse. I'm not sure if I've heard of Thomas Mann, though. Yep. Steppenwolf. Good book. Actually, one of my favorite books, Steppenwolf by Hermann Hesse. Highly recommend it. I should give that a reread, actually. I think I will. Really, really cool. Thomas Mann is on the Hemingway list. Techrific said, at some point we're going to read the Buddenbrooks. Let me know when you begin Steppenwolf. Maybe we could discuss it over at Hermann Hesse. Hey, tag me in on that when you do read Steppenwolf, or when you do discuss it at Hermann Hesse, guys. And I'd love to get in on that discussion. As I said, one of my favorite books. Techrific said, is Tolstoy pulling a Dostoevsky on us? Physical illness often points to mental states in Dostoy. Fear, shame, criminality, broken heart, anger, etc. We saw a lot of it in TBK. I'm not suggesting Dolly's onset of TB is because of Vronsky, but her irritability and behavioral change serves the dual function of indicating her state of mind concerning Vronsky. And her distraught feelings about contracting TB. Don't forget TB was very close to a death sentence in those days. I don't know if I think it was a death sentence. I'm pretty sure. I don't really think anyone bounced back from it. Maybe I'm wrong there. I'm just judging based on Red Dead Redemption 2. But yeah, no, you're right. Speaking of that, I'm watching The Sopranos and Chrissy. No, not Chrissy. What's Chrissy? No, Chris's wife. What's her name? The really sexy one. She becomes an informant for the FBI, and her fiance is like a maid mob guy, and oh man, I can't think of her name. It's really weird. I've just watched 5.5 seasons of this girl. Anyway, she's so guilty and so stressed about this situation of being in with the mafia and being an FBI informant at the same time that she develops irritable bowel syndrome. So very much the Dosto move of the physical illness as a reflection of their mental state. Swim said the mum fishy said, ha ha ha, the doctor appears to be a Russian equivalent of Dr. Oz. He is a proponent of alternative medicine and has been criticized by physicians, government officials, and publications, including Popular Science and The New Yorker. Are you talking about Dr. Oz? Sorry, I thought we were talking about the doctor in the book. For giving non-scientific advice and promoting pseudoscience. In 2014, the British Medical Journal examined over 400 medical health recommendations from 40 episodes of his program and found that only 46% of his claims were supported by reputable research, while 15% of his claims contradicted medical research, and the remainder of Oz's advice were either vague banalities or unsupported by research. Yeah, quackery's everywhere, even today. You know, I got really frustrated about some quackery today. I go to schools, right, and do talks about creative writing. and help kids make their own books. And I think it's a really good thing for kids. It's a really good positive thing for them to be part of. I'm not changing their world, I'm not changing their lives, but you know, I'm sparking an interest in literature. I'm giving them something to be proud of on the subject of books at a young age, and hopefully that turns them into more bookish people than they would have otherwise been. And that's good for their grades, which is good for their career, which is good for all kinds of things. And so I think, yeah, I think I do a lot of good in that little space of the world that I operate in. Very cool. So when the schools are looking to book people in to come and talk to their kids and inspire them in whatever way, I'm in the conversation. One of my competitors, I suppose, as someone else that they could get in to talk at their school for to motivate the kids, is, I'm not going to say any names, but there's this group. It's basically run by this guy who, and it's like, it's about like positive mental health. It's about the mental health thing for primary schools, and it's about like not bullying and being positive and being happy and like, and yeah, and all that kind of stuff. And so, oh, sounds good, right? Like, that's a good thing to do with your life. Go around to schools and try to help kids get a bit and be more, better mental health, I suppose. I don't know what I'm saying. What's the guy's background, I wonder? Like, how is he qualified to go to schools and talk to thousands of kids and teachers about mental health? A subject that you don't want to get wrong. Is he like a child psychologist, or has he been in the teaching industry for a long time? Or like, what's his deal? No, here's his qualification. Ready? He went to India once. End of qualification. He went to India and was like, had some epiphany about like happiness. And now he tours the country talking to thousands of young people with the secret to happiness. I mean, yeah, like I said, like, quackery is everywhere. That rubbed me the wrong way recently, like just researching this group that does this thing and being like, man, I'm envious because they're doing so much better than me in this space. Like, they're really popular. And why is everyone acting like this guy is some genius? I don't know. Maybe I'm just bitter and jealous. That's probably all it is. Anyway, moving right along. Oh, let's read the next chapter. That's a thing we could do. This is chapter 2 of part 2. This is a long episode. I do apologize, but I'm having fun chatting with you guys, so whatever. Just after the doctor had left, Dolly came. She knew that there was to be a consultation that day, and though she had only recently got up after a confinement, she had given birth to a daughter at the end of winter. And though she had many... Wait, who gave birth to a daughter? Dolly. Oh. And though she had many troubles and cares of her own, she left her baby and another little girl of hers who was ill and called to her to hear Kitty's fate, which was to be decided that day. "Well, how is she?" she said, entering the drawing room without removing her bonnet. In those days, it was the fashion for married women to wear bonnets rather than hats, according to the footnote. "You're all very cheerful, so it must be all right." They tried to tell her what the doctor had said, but it turned out that though he had spoken very fluently and at great length, it was impossible to reproduce what he had said. The only thing of interest was that it had been decided they should go abroad. Dolly could not suppress a sigh. Her best friend, her sister, was going away, and as it was, her life was not a bright one. Not a bright one. Her relations with her husband, after their reconciliation, had become humiliating. Anna's soldering had not proved durable, and the family harmony had broken again at the same place. There was nothing definite, but Oblonsky was hardly ever at home. There was hardly ever any money, and suspicions of his infidelity continually tormented Dolly, who tried to repel them, fearing the already familiar pangs of jealousy. The first explosion of jealousy, once past, could not be repeated. Not even the discovery of an act of infidelity could again affect her as it had done the first time. Such a discovery could now only deprive her of her accustomed family life. And she let herself be deceived, despising him and especially herself for such weakness. Added to this, the care of a large family worried her continually. Either something went wrong with the feeding of the baby, or the nurse left, or, as now, one of the children fell ill. "And how are you all getting on?" asked her mother. "Ah, Mama, we have plenty of trouble of our own. Lily has fallen ill, and I'm afraid it's scarlet fever. I have even come out today to hear the news. Because I shall not come out at all if, which God forbid, it really is scarlet fever. The old prince came out of his study after the doctor had gone, and after giving his cheek to Dolly and greeting her, he turned to his wife. Well, have you made up your minds to go? And what are you going to do with me? I think you should stay behind, Alexander," replied his wife. "As you please." "Mama, why should not Papa come with us?" said Kitty. "It would be pleasanter for him and for us to do so." The old prince rose and stroked Kitty's hair. She lifted her face and, forcing a smile, looked up at him. She always felt that he understood her better than anyone else in the family, though he did not speak much to her. Being the youngest, she was his favourite, and it seemed to her that his affection gave him insight. When her gaze now met his kindly blue eyes, looking steadily at her, it seemed to her that he saw right through her, and knew all the trouble that was in her. She bent towards him, blushing and expecting a kiss, but he only patted her on the head and remarked, "These stupid chignons. One can't get at one's real daughter, but only caresses the hair of expired females. Well, Dolly," he said, turning to his eldest daughter, "and what is your prodigal about?" "Nothing particular, Papa," answered Dolly, understanding that he referred to her husband. "He is always out. I hardly see him," she could not resist adding with an ironical smile. "And has he not yet gone to the country to sell the forest?" "Nope, he is always preparing to go." "Dear me," said the prince, "and so I am also to prepare. I am all obedience," he said to his wife, as he sat down again. "And look here, Kate," he went on, turning to his youngest daughter, "you must wake up one fine morning and say to yourself, why am I quite well and happy and will... Why, I am quite hell... Sorry, okay, let me do that again. And say to yourself, why, I am quite well and happy, and will go out to walk in the frost again with Papa. Eh?" Her father's words seemed very simple, but they made Kitty feel as confused and flurried as a detected criminal. "Yes, he knows and understands it all, and in these words is telling me that, though I am ashamed, I must get over my shame." She could not gather spirit enough to reply. She made an attempt, but suddenly burst into tears and ran away. The princess flew at her husband. "That comes of your jokes. You always..." And she began reproaching him. The prince listened for some time to her rebukes in silence, but his face frowned more and more. "She is so pitiful, the poor thing, so pitiful, and you don't feel that every allusion to what has caused it hurts her." "Oh dear, oh dear, to be so mistaken in anyone," said the princess, and from the change in her tone, both Dolly and the prince knew that she was thinking of Vronsky. "I can't think why we have no laws to punish such horrid, ignoble people." "Oh, it makes me so sick to hear it," muttered the prince gloomily, rising as if he meant to go away, but stopping at the door. "The laws are there, my dear, and since you have invited it, I will tell you who is at fault for it all. You and you, and no one but you. There always have been, and there still are, laws against such fellows, yes, and if nothing had been done that ought not to have been done, I, old as I am, would have challenged him, that fop. Yes, now go and dose her, and call in these quacks." The prince appeared to have much more to say, but as soon as the princess heard this tone, she, as always happened in serious cases, gave in and became repentant. "Alexander, Alexander," she whispered, moving nearer and bursting into tears. As soon as she began to cry, the prince quieted down and came up to her. "That will do, that will do. You suffer too, I know. It can't be helped. There's no great harm done. God is merciful, thank you." he went on, no longer knowing what he was saying, and after responding to his wife's wet kiss, which he felt on his hand, he went out. When Kitty, in tears, had left the room, Dolly, with her motherly habit of mind, at once saw that here a woman's task lay before her, and prepared to fulfill it. She took off her bonnet, and having mentally rolled up her sleeves, prepared for action. While her mother was attacking her father, she tried to restrain the former as far as filial respect permitted. When the prince flared up, she kept silent, feeling shame for her mother and tenderness towards her father because of his immediate return to kindliness. But when her father left the room, she was ready for the chief thing needful, which was to go to Kitty and comfort her. I wanted to tell you something long ago, Mama. Do you know that Levin wished to propose to Kitty when he was here last? He told Stephen. Well, what of that? I don't understand. Perhaps Kitty rejected him. Did she not tell you? No, she told me nothing about either. She is too proud. But I know it is all because of that. Yes, and just imagine if she refuses Levin, and she would not have refused him if it had not been for that other. I know. And then the other deceived her so dreadfully. It was too dreadful for the princess to think how much she was to blame in regard to her daughter, and she grew angry. Oh, I can't make anything out. Nowadays, girls all want to trust to their own reason. They don't tell their mothers anything. And then, Mama, I will go to her. Go. Am I preventing you? Said the mother. All right, there we go. Another chapter down, another long podcast down. Thank you very much for listening. Very much appreciated. I'll see you tomorrow.